All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've got a hell of a show for you today. Guess what we're going to be talking about? We're going to be talking at the back end of the show with Dr. Michael Mann, and we're going to be talking about climate change, Trump, and the attacks on scientists. This is going to be a very, very, very interesting, very heavy section of the show. But before that, one of the things that we're going to be talking about, and this is something that should be eating at everyone and something that everyone needs to actually know what's going on, all right? And that is we're going to be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party
and one of the initiators of RefuseFascism.org.
And you might recall seeing Carl being dragged out of the congressional hearings concerning Jefferson Beauregard Sessions and his confirmation to be the new attorney general. And Carl has been in D.C. ever since, and he's here to talk with us now about what's happening in D.C. and the need to prevent the Trump-Pence regime from consolidating power. Carl, really glad to hook up with you. Welcome back to the show, man.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into this, though. You've been at the heart of the Refuse Fascism campaign in D.C. all this week. Can you give us first an idea of what's been going on, where things are at, up to and including today?
Okay. Where things are at today is, look, the Trump-Pence fascist regime was inaugurated. That's what happened, but not without significant protests and not without some disruptions. There are reports that half a dozen of the checkpoints that people had to pass through to get to the inaugural parade were shut down for different periods of time by protests. There are thousands of protesters in different parts of D.C. You'll see a demonstration of 1,000 people going west, meeting up with a demonstration of 1,500 people going east, and then proceeding together. And this is some growth over what had been going on, because RefuseFascism.org had called for people to flood the streets of D.C. before the inauguration. And while there had been dozens and even at times hundreds of people in the street, that's as far as it got. There was no flood. And we called for that because we felt an urgent need to stop this regime before it gets started and before it could consolidate its hold on power. Because we have seen in history what happens when fascists get their hands on the reins of power and are able to wield that power. They crush their opposition. And we are dealing with an American Hitler who maybe doesn't have that little black mustache, but he has the fascist agenda that would make Hitler proud. And we have to stop this regime from consolidating its hold on power, because that will mean that Muslims will be required to register with the government. Immigrants will be rounded up in even more horrific numbers and deported than under Obama. The press will be muzzled. People's citizenship will even be under attack if they dissent or criticize Mein Trump. So that is why we've called for people to act to stop this. And we were not able to stop it before it happened, but it is not over. People are in the streets right now, and we're calling on them to stay in the streets. We're calling on the people flooding into D.C. for the Women's March to not make this a one-day march and go home, but to stay in D.C. And if you can't stay in D.C., to get into the streets wherever you are. We have to keep this going and act to stop this regime before it can consolidate its hold on power.
All right, and I do want to remind people again, basically, you should be going to the website, refusefascism.org, as many times as possible throughout the coming period to keep up on this and find out what's going on, what you can do, what the situation is, what's needed, all this kind of stuff, and to understand the basic things that we're talking about even now in terms of what's happened and what needs to happen. Now, Carl, one of the things, in terms of what you're talking about, it's very important what you're digging at, and I wanted to explore this a little bit more. I know when I first started talking to people about this whole campaign, one of the things people said to me was like, you know, look, I really love it. I really love it, man, but I just don't think it's possible. And I think that might be a question that people are having today. And I think it's important to speak to that to a certain degree. You don't have to dig into all kinds of stuff, but to really explain, okay, what are you saying? Do you still think it's possible?
Look, I think here is the, because that's a very good question. And it's one that we've encountered quite a bit, because we started marching in D.C. last Saturday. Every day that we were out, up to today, we found a whole lot of people who were with us in our condemnation of Trump as a racist, a woman hater, and many people who were with us in terms of characterizing his regime as fascist. Some of them would even join us for brief periods of time in the street. But when they heard we were acting to stop it, they were like, I wish you could succeed, but I don't think so. And see, here is why there's a basis to do this. There are millions and millions and millions of people who feel that way, who hate everything that Trump represents, who feel it in their gut that this is going to be a horror for humanity. And instead of looking for someone at the top, somebody in the Democratic Party, some checks and balances in the system to take care of this for us, we have to recognize that if those of us who felt that way began to flood into the streets, now it's thousands. If it could go to tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and millions, it could create a political crisis that would change the whole calculations of those on top. It could force the development of a mechanism to remove this regime from power. See, and we need to look at Tahrir Square 6 years ago in Egypt. When people in Egypt first went into Tahrir Square, I'm sure they were told this couldn't happen. It was impossible. You can't do anything about the Mubarak regime. But as more and more people flooded into the streets, as Egyptians in their millions were in the streets, it forced a crisis that those at the top had to resolve. The same thing is going on right now in South Korea. Millions of people flocking into the street in opposition to President Park and her government. And what she's doing, the crime that they're removing her for, because she got impeached for corruption. Corruption on the part of a South Korean president is not a new development. What is unusual is the authorities developing an impeachment campaign over the corruption. And it was because of the crisis of large numbers of Korean people challenging the legitimacy of a particular government. The Trump regime, which was just inaugurated, was illegitimate before it was inaugurated. It was illegitimate because of the fascist agenda that it campaigned on, because of the fascists that it was collecting in the cabinet to carry out that agenda. And every step along the way that this regime takes, and they're planning to hit the ground running, so there will be horrible steps that they take, are illegitimate. And people need to act on their feelings of outrage, disgust, and anguish, and create that political crisis by flooding the streets in their millions.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the initiators of the refusefascism.org movement. You know, one of the things that's happened already, and somebody just told me before we went on air, one of the first things that Trump has said he's going to do is he's about to undo Obama's climate action plan, which is going to have a huge impact on the proliferation of fossil fuels and all this other stuff that's actually going to be even more destroying what we use to breathe, right? We used to live on. So it's very heavy when you're talking about in the very moment, the moments after he's inaugurated, this is what comes down, one of the most essential issues facing the entire planet, and he's saying, to hell with that. I wanted to ask you this, though, too, because in terms of what you're talking about, I think it's important to go through this a little. James Baldwin, he once said that not everything that's faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. And I wonder if you think some of that might apply to actually the situation we're wrestling with right now in terms of actually being able to break out into a whole new realm of things.
Yeah, because see, the situation is just straight up. There are many, many people who would like to see this stop, but they feel there's nothing they can do. And so they don't want to face the reality of this regime and what it means. They try to convince themselves that maybe it won't be as bad as they fear it might be. And see, the reality is it will be that bad. I mean, the man told you what he was going to do. He revealed to you what he was. You know, you heard those boasts of sexual assaults on women. Then he appoints an attorney general who says, well, I'm not sure that grabbing a woman by her genitals is a crime. That's the very definition of sexual attack, sexual assault. But his attorney general doesn't think it's a crime. He told you he was going to undo the less than adequate steps that had already been taken around climate change. He also told you he's going to create a Muslim registry. People need to think about the Stars of David that Jewish people were forced to wear during the Nazi regime. He told you that he wants to deport 3 million immigrants in his first year. He told you he wants to bring stop and frisk, an unconstitutional policing policy that targets black and brown people as permanent suspects, guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence. He wants to spread that across the country. He's told you who he is and what he will do, and people should not hope to get by with that till the next election. Should not view it like, let's give him a chance. Maybe the office will mature him and give him a better sense of what he should do. He is going to carry out a fascist agenda unless we act to stop it. And everybody needs to confront that and act on it. You know, people in church groups. I mean, I was out at some protests yesterday that were being pepper sprayed by the police, different things like that. I know everybody's not ready to do that, but a lot of people are, and those who are ready to do that need to be in the streets showing that they're not going to accept this regime. But if you're not ready for that form of activity, your church group could have a prayer vigil showing that they refuse to accept this fascist regime. Students need to act. Labor unions need to act. Everybody needs to come out and to display their refusal to accept this illegitimate fascist regime. And that contributes to causing a political crisis that could force the removal of this regime before it consolidates its hold on power. That's what humanity needs. And in the name of humanity, we should be acting to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of a couple of things. I mean, again, hearkening back to Baldwin's, basically his statement that, you know, nothing can be changed until it is faced. And people have to face this and face it in a lot of ways. I think one is that, you know, there is this thing about really recognizing that this fascist regime is a whole different character than a reactionary president or somebody who's going to, you know, this is not, look, as much as people hated George Bush and could toss around the word fascism and fascist in relation to George Bush, this is a different thing that's going on. You actually have, right now, with the inauguration, there has been the door open to a fascist regime. This is what was inaugurated. You know, so people facing up to that reality. And then what does that mean? It seems to me that there's a couple things that really people need to think about in relation to this. And that is, like, even with protests, is what you're saying, you just made me think about this, what you were saying about the other forms of action that people can take. But all of this has to actually be not just separate protests. It has to be not just things out for individual interests or anything else, or even just protesting. There has to be so much more, I think, that's actually unfolding in relation to this, if we're ever going to get to this place that we need to get to.
Yeah, because see, protesting, look, we welcome people flooding into D.C. this weekend to register that they oppose Trump and his agenda. But a protest that registers your opposition and then you go home afterward and that's it, that's not enough. We need an effort of people flowing into the streets, getting into the streets here in D.C. and staying in the streets. And we're taking a message to people who are coming to D.C., today and tomorrow for the Women's March and today for the protests at the inauguration. Hey, don't go back. Stay here in D.C. Join us in the streets, acting to prevent this. If you have to go back to where you came from, get in the streets there, because this is going to take a sustained effort aimed at ousting this regime. And look, I've talked about some of the horrors that this regime means. But people need to get that this is something different. This is a leap in all of the attacks, the injustices that this system has brought down on people. And people who know me know that I've been out there fighting these injustices for decades. But this is going to be a leap in all those injustices. And beyond that, even worse than that, more than that, is that there's going to be an attempt to suffocate the room to stand up and fight them. Let's look at his talk in this press conference about this media outlet is fake news and I will not take a question from him. This is all aimed at muzzling the press, silencing it. Look at his talk about taking away citizenship from people who burn the flag. Look at how he's whipped up a lynch mob atmosphere that targets people who are critical of him, so that journalists have had to hire private security to deal with a flood of death threats that they've gotten. You know, people in Germany, when Hitler first took power, had a slogan, "Nach Hitler uns," which is German for "after Hitler us," thinking that they would be able to get in and carry out their program after Hitler fumbled everything and that he wasn't going to be able to handle it. He got into power and he crushed his opposition. Trump has the same aims, and that's what fascism does. It doesn't just increase the injustices in society, although it does do that, but it also crushes opposition to its rule. And if we give them a chance to do that, it will be far, far, far more difficult to fight any of these injustices. That's why we have called for people to stop this regime before it can consolidate its hold on power. We're calling on people to stay in the streets here in D.C. We're going to be calling for people to march in D.C. after the women's march is over. Come back out in D.C. Monday. And all of this will be posted up on the website, refusefascism.org. People need to check that website out and get involved. If you're not in D.C., get involved in Los Angeles. Get involved in New York City, in Chicago. And if there's nothing happening where you are, start something. But be part of this effort to oust this fascist regime.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the initiators of the RefuseFascism.org movement. Carl, I got a couple more questions for you, if you're able to do this. And one of them is basically, again, talking about needing to face what we're actually up against and what's required. It's also important in that realm to actually think about, when you're talking about what makes this possible to happen, there's what makes it necessary and then what makes it possible. And there's a relationship there, but there's also, even in unexpected places, I mean, it is interesting what has been set loose in the Congress, what's been set loose with all the opposition to coming to Trump's inauguration, you know, and how that actually unfolds. And what happened with John Lewis and Trump and John Lewis's refusal to just sort of meekly walk away has given people a sense of, okay, there are contradictions that are going on that might actually be some cracks that things can get through. And similar things have happened on other fronts as well.
Yeah, see, that's important. I mean, and when John Lewis made his statement about Trump's illegitimacy, it actually opened things up even wider maybe than Lewis intended. Because Lewis was talking about some issues at the top in relation to the role that the Russians may have played in, you know, hacking Clinton's emails and exposure and stuff like that. But then Trump comes back at him with disrespectful and frankly racist tweets, and that opens it up for large numbers of black people and others who see the racism of a Donald Trump and whose take on his illegitimacy is that a racist like that should not have the reins of power in his hands, somebody who is calling on open white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and others out from under their rocks that they were under in this society, and actually bringing some of their representatives into the White House should be nowhere near the reins of power. And that made it a very big question among the masses of people. That's why Cornel West and I issued a call for people to wear an I standing for illegitimate to show their stance on the Trump, Pence regime and their opposition to it. And to turn that from a stance against the regime into acting to prevent it from consolidating its hold on power. Because the splits at the top on their own aren't going to go anywhere. You know, Lewis might call out Trump as illegitimate. A couple dozen other Congress people might boycott the inauguration, but that's not going to go over to an actual fight against the Trump regime absent an upsurge, a surge of people from below. If we surge into the streets in our millions, that could force political crisis, that could spur activity at the top to replace and remove this regime before it could consolidate its hold on power.
You know, one other thing I thought was really interesting, too, in terms of, again, facing up to what we're facing and what's really going on is it is important, I think, in terms of people understanding the character of the overall thing, too. This point about people like Obama and Bernie Sanders and Biden and all these people saying, look, we should make nice with Trump. If we're not making nice, we should give him a chance, look at him, you know, be on his tail. And basically, this is what we got. We got to work with it. I think that presents to a lot of people a question of like, whoa, really? Is this what we have to do? And then trying to understand why that's a deadly trap. That's a trap that is going to lead us right back to what we're talking about in terms of this is a fascist regime. If you haven't studied fascism or looked at it, you should, like you were saying, look at what happened in Germany, look what happens in other places where suddenly fascists come into power. There are things that actually could have been faced then and need to be faced now by people in their many millions in order for this to really break loose, I think.
Yeah, see, this is important for people to get because when Obama says that he and Trump are on the same team and that this was an intramural contest between them, he's actually telling you something. He's telling you that we both represent the same system, the capitalist imperialist system, and our main goal is to keep that system intact. And even their differences are over what's the best way to do that. But for the masses of people around the world and in this country, that system is and has been nothing but a horror for the majority of people, the billions of people around the world. And we need to actually just take apart the logic of working with Trump where you agree with him. Because that comes down to saying, if Hitler was providing jobs for some of the German people, we should work with him on that and step over or ignore the attacks that he was unleashing on Jewish people. And frankly, too many Germans did exactly that. And we see where that took us. And working with Trump where you can will take you to the same place because he has the same agenda. And if some of the Democrats find that it syncs with things that they want to do and therefore they will step over and ignore the flaming, blood-drenched fascist program that Trump is carrying out, they are taking us in the same direction. And see, history harshly judges the good Germans, the German people who stood aside while Hitler carried out his crimes, and rightly so. But here's the thing. This ain't just a question of history. This question is right up in front of us now. We have an American Hitler in Donald Trump. He's taking the reins of power in this society. And the question then becomes, will the people in this country, the people, millions and millions and millions of whom see the horrors that Trump represents, sit back and let that go down? Mm-hmm. Will millions of others try to step around those horrors because they think maybe there is something that will improve their situation that could come down? And I have to tell these people, these promises of Trump providing jobs, it's probably has about as much worth as a degree from Trump University.
Ooh.
It's illusory.
Yeah.
But even if it did come through, it is not worth, you getting a better job is not worth the horrors that it will bring down on humanity. In the name of humanity, people need to flood the streets here in D.C. and everywhere else to act right now, seize on the window that still exists, to prevent this regime from getting its power consolidating and carrying it out and exercising it in society.
All right, Carl, is there one people should get in touch with refusefascism.org? Is there an email?
There is an email, and I'm blanking on what it is.
Okay, we'll have to go
to the website, people.
Right. Okay,
you can find the other ways to contact it.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. I have a national phone number.
Okay.
info@refusefascism.org.
Okay, good. info@refusefascism.org, and you go to the website refusefascism.org and check it out, folks. Hook up with people. Find out what they're doing. That's what the first step you got to make. You got to make that step to say, look, I'm going to find out what's happening. And that's really important. So, Carl, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Anything you want to add before we split?
That's it. We got the website out there. And thank you for having me on, Mike.
All right, Carl. Talk to you again, man. Take care. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the initiators of refusefascism.org, all right? And this is something that people should really take this and spread it around to all of your friends, all right, because this has got to get out there. All right, now before we leave this section of the show, I wanted to give you a sense of Trump's first days. His first day, January 20th, he signed an executive order stating that the administration's official policy is to seek the prompt repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Two professors at the City University of New York recently estimated that getting rid of the Affordable Care Act would result in 44,000 excess deaths each year. The White House website was immediately changed to eliminate pages on climate change, LGBT rights, and health care. It now says President Trump is committed to eliminating harmful and unnecessary policies such as the Climate Action Plan and the Waters of the U.S. rule. Trump signed executive orders advancing both the controversial Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota Access Pipeline in Standing Rock, North Dakota. He signed an order reinstating the so-called global gag rule, making discussion of abortion for any purpose by any NGO receiving U.S. government support illegal. It was revealed that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control quietly and abruptly canceled a major climate change gathering scheduled for February. The action was taken after Donald Trump's election, but is only now coming to light. The EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, reportedly suspended its contracts and funding for air quality, climate change, and emission reduction programs and ordered its employees to secrecy. Trump informed the National Park Service that they could no longer engage in tweeting after it retweeted side-by-side images showing the crowds at Obama's 2009 inauguration and Trump's much tinier inauguration. Speaking at CIA headquarters, Trump raised the possibility of a new war in Iraq, saying, "We should have kept the oil. Maybe we'll have another chance." He has made military threats against China. His press secretary, Sean Spicer, said the U.S. would prevent China from taking over territory in international waters in the South China Sea. His Secretary of State nominee had previously said that the U.S. would not allow China access to islands it has built in the South China Sea, and upon which it has installed weapon systems and built military-length airstrips. On January 20th, Trump was given the codes for launching nuclear weapons. As they say, it might be time to do a little bit more than bending over and kissing your butt goodbye. We're going to quickly move right into our next piece here, which is Outer National, a band that people, if you've been listening to my show for a long time, you know I've been a big fan of this, and I've really considered it very important to support and promote them. And they're out with a new song, and it says, Outer National, a band, not a brand. Welcome to the fascist twilight zone, my friends. Miles Soleil writing that saying, welcome to the fascist twilight zone, my friends, and I present to you the new Outer National song, Decision. All right, so check this out.
Prepare
All right. That was, once again, that was a new piece from Outer National called Decision. And I'm going to read you something that Miles wrote when he sent this piece out to people. He said, "I'm writing to you from the USA on the morning that a fascist regime is being coronated. I will be in the streets of Washington, D.C. today and tomorrow. The regime of Donald Trump and Mike Pence is illegitimate because fascism is illegitimate. If ever there was a time in our lives to act as if the future depended on us, now would be that time." Miles Saleh calls on people to get involved and take to the streets wherever you are. That's from Miles Saleh from Outer National. Right now, we're going to move into a conversation I had with Michael Mann. Dr. Michael Mann is a climate scientist. We talked with him about climate change, Trump, and the attacks on scientists. So here's the conversation I had with Mike Mann just a couple days ago. All right, and I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Dr. Michael Mann. And Dr. Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science and director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State University. His research focuses on understanding climate variability and human-caused climate change. He's authored more than 200 publications and 3 books, including Dire Predictions, Understanding Climate Change, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, and The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. And damn, man, you can't concentrate where we're at today any better than that. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Always good to be with you.
Yeah, you too, man. I've been meaning to have you back much sooner, and I'm really glad we get the chance to do this.
Yeah.
Let's jump into it because there's a hell of a lot going on. Right off the top of my head, rapid increase in the temperature of the planet, global warming, all the horrors that roll out from that. What's actually the impact on humans, human life, on the human future, all the other life on the planet itself? Unbridled pillaging of the planet. What the hell is happening? And then into all that comes Trump. And any reasonable individual might be inclined to start this interview by saying or asking you, we're screwed, man, aren't we?
Well, I'll tell you, our book, The Madhouse Effect, my co-author is Tom Tolles, the Washington Post cartoonist, and you may have seen his hard-hitting cartoons in the Washington Post when it comes to climate change. He's really been calling out climate change denialism for years and has been one of the most prominent voices in our media doing so. And so it seemed natural to join forces with him to write a book about climate change and climate change denial. Now, I'll tell you, in the fall when our book came out, I can't tell you how many colleagues of mine said, "Oh, you know, climate change denial, we're past that. That's over. We've moved on from that. The discussion moving forward is going to be about the solutions." And, of course, given the result of election, of course, things played out very differently. And now we see that climate change denial has established a stronghold in the very highest levels of our government. We have an incoming president who is a climate change denier, who is appointing to key posts other climate change deniers, many of whom are connected with the Koch brothers or ExxonMobil, two of the largest funders of climate change misinformation and disinformation campaigns. And he will find common cause with a Congress led by Republicans who, by and large, also are completely in denial that the problem even exists. And so we have an uphill challenge when it comes to making progress at sort of the executive level and at the congressional level. And we're going to have to look to efforts at the grassroots, at cities, municipalities, and states, and working together with other nations around the world. We can still, tackle this problem, but we're going to have to do it without the support of the U.S. federal government.
Well, let me ask you about a couple of these individuals in particular, because some of them, I mean, these people are ghouls as far as I can make out. Scott Pruitt, for instance, let's talk about him a little bit. He is like ghoul among ghouls.
Yeah, so he's been nominated to head up EPA, and he's the Attorney General of Oklahoma, who spent much of his time suing the EPA, trying to block efforts to regulate carbon emissions. He is on record dismissing climate change as unproven science, when in fact it's about as proven as the theory of gravity. As I like to say, proof is reserved for alcoholic beverages and mathematical theorems. In science, we don't prove things, but we demonstrate overwhelming evidence for a hypothesis, for a theory, for a particular idea. And there is as widespread a consensus about human-caused climate change as there is about anything in science today. And so when you have somebody say something like, well, the science is unproven, he might as well say the science of gravity is unproven. He's dismissing out of hand the overwhelming
consensus of the world scientists that climate change is real, it's human-caused, and it's already a problem. And so, you know, it would be a disaster to put somebody like that at the head of the EPA. I wrote a column about the various nominees, Trump's nominations that he's made for EPA, Department of Energy, et cetera, and the title of which was A Hen House for Rent, Only Foxes Need Apply, because what we're literally seeing here is appointing foxes to guard that hen house of science and the environment.
Each and every one of them, and Trump himself, this idea that sort of like, well, you know, look, if they don't come out outright and say, this is all bogus, we're opposed to this, we don't think it's real, we're going to go steamroll ahead, they actually come out and say this point that they always use to take down things that are actually being fought for, that are true and have to be fought for and established. And they come out and say, well, you know, you can't prove it. You know, it's you got to have an open mind. Come on, give me a break, you know.
Right. Why is it that we don't have an open mind when it comes to banning toxic substances? Wherever science provides guidance in our lives, many of these critics are more than happy to accept science, except when the science happens to have implications that they don't like. And in this case, the implications they don't like is that these guys are very closely allied with fossil fuel interests. They are doing the bidding. Scott Pruitt was actually letting fossil fuel interests ghostwrite the various letters he was writing criticizing the EPA. He literally had industry people writing his letters for him, and the various threats of subpoenas. And so what people like Pruitt don't like is the fact that the implications of the science may be inconvenient for the fossil fuel interests that line his pockets and that have funded him and promoted him.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science and the Director of the Earth Science System Center at Penn State University. You know, one of the things that just going through, I don't know if there's anybody else in that whole crew of clowns that you wanted to actually speak to directly, because I was going to move on. But if you have something really you want to say about any of them?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's some irony to appointing Rick Perry to head up the Department of Energy when he couldn't even remember the Department of Energy in the presidential debate. So he would eliminate the department if he could remember what it is. And, of course, he's on record, you know, making various statements that are just sort of boilerplate climate change denialism, just sort of parroting the standard climate change denier talking points. That is true of just about every single one of Trump's nominations, including most recently now, just yesterday, the apparent nominee for a presidential science advisor, David Glertner of Yale, a computer scientist, who is a climate change denier. And so it would almost be comical if it weren't so pernicious and dangerous.
That's exactly it. Even as I sort of chuckled around the thing with Perry, I was thinking, wait a minute, there's nothing at all funny about any of this, because it's, you start to think how absurd it is, but then you realize this is actually happening, you know?
Well, it's, you know, the humor is sort of gallows humor.
Yeah,
because that's what we're really talking about here.
Yeah. One thing is that in relation to all this, there's, you know, a big part of this fight around this situation has been the assault on people like yourself who've actually been out there fighting for science and for the truth behind stuff. There's also been some pretty vicious and slanderous attacks on you guys, on scientists in general, and you in particular, around what you're learning about global warming, what you're saying, what it's going to take to deal with that. Give people a sense of what's happening on this front, because you've seen and you've been the target of some very vicious stuff, and you've also seen some things happening.
Yeah, it worries many of us who have been through attacks by senators and congressmen like James Inhofe, like Joe Barton, who are in the pay of fossil fuel interests and have abused their power to, you know, hold hearings, hostile hearings, putting scientists like me in the hot seat and vilifying us and attacking us. You know, we have been at the receiving end of death threats. And much of this, it doesn't just happen by chance. It's because there's a coordinated effort by fossil fuel interests and their paid advocates and the front groups that they fund to vilify scientists like myself so that they can sort of get their base riled up. And it leads to all sorts of nasty attacks, threats of violence. You know, it's sad to say that that's sort of the cost of doing business, in a sense. If you're a climate scientist today, then you have to be prepared to be viciously attacked simply by those who find inconvenient the results of your science and your efforts to communicate that to the public. But and I wrote this in an op-ed in the Washington Post about a month ago, where I was speaking to the public, but also to my fellow scientists. And the bottom line at the end, I said, we have to have courage. Fundamentally, we have to have the courage required to continue to speak truth to power here, because the stakes just couldn't be greater. The stakes literally are the fate of this planet.
Mm-hmm. Very important. You know, and the thing is when you talk about all this, there's actually people need to understand that the attempt to smear you is aimed at you, but it's aimed at the impact that your voice has and what you're putting out there has, you and other scientists who are actually using science and developing our scientific understanding and our understanding of the world. And that's the only way that humanity has been able to live in some form of coexistence with the planet itself and everything else on it. And it's been a hard-fought battle, and it's not won at all. But now you look at this, and there's all kinds of things that are happening out here. And I was thinking, even, frankly, there's been the threats against you, and then there's been the attempts to just, like, really rake you over the coals in ways that other people, I don't know if people really understand what has actually been done to you and people who are in your same sort of collection of people. But in particular, what I know about is it's what's happened to you in relation to the assault on you, because it's been very heavy, man, over a number of years.
Yeah, that's right. And there are similar assaults, you know, on other scientists. But to some extent, they've been even more intense in my case, because there really is a motive behind these attacks. My co-authors and I, back in the late 1990s, nearly two decades ago, published the famous hockey stick curve. It was an estimate of temperature changes over the last 1,000 years, and it really drove home just how profound the changes that we are seeing today, how unprecedented they are. The spike of the last century is sort of the blade of this curve that looks like a hockey stick upturned, with the blade, the upward blade, taking us to levels, temperatures that we haven't seen in at least 1,000 years. And it became really an icon. That curve became iconic in the climate change debate, the hockey stick. And because of that, it drew the attention and ire of climate change deniers, of fossil fuel industry-funded climate change deniers and front groups that advocate for them, all sought to try to discredit the hockey stick by attacking me personally. Ironically, that placed me at the center of this larger debate. It's not something that I signed up for when I decided to go into this area of science, when I studied applied math and physics as an undergraduate at UC Berkeley and went off to do a PhD in theoretical physics. And ultimately, it led me into the field of climate research. But it wasn't a career trajectory that one would follow to position oneself at the center of one of the most contentious societal debates that we've ever had. But it is ultimately where I found myself. And I decided ultimately, though, that though it wasn't what I had signed up for, it wasn't really what I had wanted or planned to do with my life, the prominence that the hockey stick sort of provided for me and the fact that it made me sort of a central figure in the climate change debate meant that I had an opportunity to inform this extremely important discussion. And ultimately, I've embraced that, because I can't think of anything more important that I could do with my life than try to inform this discussion about what may be the greatest threat that we have faced as a civilization. In a sense, I consider myself, you know, almost blessed to be in a position to do that.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science and the Director of the Earth Science System Center at Penn State University. And we're talking about what the hell is going on with the climate as Herr Trump and Heil Trump come marching into power. You know, one of the things that also I came across and began to understand a little bit more deeply as I was researching for this conversation, this atmosphere of McCarthyism that's really been brought into full play here. And it's come against you and other scientists as well, people who are more inclined to tell the truth than to go along with the program. You've been subpoenaed by Congress. You've had all kinds of things happen to you. Give people a sense of what that meant, that kind of repression.
Yeah, I mean, so I've seen it all. I've been had my personal emails subpoenaed by Joe Barton back in 2005, the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, largest recipient of fossil fuel money in the U.S. House of Representatives at the time, from Texas, attempted to subpoena all of my emails and every document from my career. And it was ultimately, there was such widespread opposition to him, even from members of his own party like John McCain and Sherwood Bollert, who was the Republican chair of the House Science Committee at the time, that ultimately Barton backed off. But then later on, in 2009, Ken Cuccinelli, incoming Attorney General of Virginia, decided to basically use the same playbook and try to demand all of my personal emails from the time I was at the University of Virginia. That ultimately went to the Virginia Supreme Court, where Cuccinelli's witch hunt, to use the wording of a Washington Post editorial, was rejected by the court. And, you know, I've talked about some of the other things that I and colleagues of mine have been subject to, death threats. I've received an envelope in the mail with a white powder, and I'd have the FBI come in and check it out. And there was police tape over the door to my office, and it was fear that not just me, but that my colleagues could have been exposed to a dangerous substance. I've had threats made against my family. I have had demands made by Republican state senators for Penn State to fire me. In fact, there was a threat by state Republicans to withhold the entire budget of Penn State, the state budget for Penn State, if they did not take some punitive action against me for fabricated allegations about me and colleagues based on stolen emails that had been, quote, mined and misrepresented. So you name it. I have been subject to just about every possible form of attack, intimidation, threat. But what continues to give me strength is knowing, first of all, that these attacks, in a sense, speak to the fact that what my colleagues and I are doing is important. These people wouldn't be going after us like this if there wasn't something important that we were communicating to the public and if we weren't being somewhat effective in doing that. And that gives me strength to continue to sort of push forward. And I have great faith in the notion that truth will out in the end, that ultimately scientific truth will rule the day. And the fear, of course, is that climate change deniers who have now hijacked the highest levels of our government may delay action long enough that we commit to ever more dangerous changes in climate that will impact not just us, but our children and grandchildren. As I said before, the stakes couldn't be any greater, and that's a big part of why I and others are still fighting to try to make progress on this issue.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about as you were speaking, too, is that, as you're saying, scientists who have spoken out about this, another way they've come at people, yourself included, has been by accusing you of being politicized scientists, that actually you're in pursuit of a political agenda that actually doesn't have anything to do with science.
Yeah, right. I mean, so politicians come after you and attack you, and other sort of political partisans engage in a campaign to vilify you. And then when you try to fight back, they accuse you of being the one who's politicizing matters. It's deeply cynical. It is sort of the tried and true poisonous politics of folks like Karl Rove that he helped hone, where one attacks their opponent and accuses them of the very improprieties that they themselves are actually guilty of. Some call that projection. When they come after us and say, we're in it for the money, well, no. You don't go into science if you want to make a lot of money. There are lots of areas. If you have great mathematical ability, you can go to Wall Street, you can go into the business world, you can make a lot of money if that's what is important to you. What is important to most scientists, like myself, isn't making a whole lot of money. It's spending your life working on things that challenge you, that you're interested in, that you think are important, and you love doing. We love doing science, and that's more important to us than monetary reward. Indeed, it's those who are accusing us of being in science for the money who are actually lining their pockets with fossil fuel money. So it's deeply cynical, and yet too often it's effective, and that's why they do it.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science and the Director of the Earth Science System Center at Penn State University. You know, one of the things that struck me, too, as you were speaking, is that Lamar Smith, in relation to all of this, the head of the House Committee of Science, Space, and Technology, and he actually has argued that scientists should be supported only so long as their work is in the national interest. Politicized?
His opinion of what the national interest is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because there it doesn't matter that actually you're politicized. There's actually, he's demanding that scientists be politicized.
In fact, in other ways, Lamar Smith is the same So as you see, ironically, the chair of the House Science Committee 10 years ago, it was Sherwood Bollert who was the chair of the House Science Committee, and he was one of the Republicans of conscience that fought back against Barton because he believed in science.
Hmm.
And how far we've come since then, where we now have somebody leading, a Republican leading the House Science Committee, who stands for anti-science, who stands for the opposite of everything that science is about. And when it comes to accusations of politicizing, Lamar Smith actually wanted to dissolve the entire system of peer review, which is sort of a fundamental part of science, is that other scientists get to critique your work and you reply. It's part of the self-correcting machinery that Carl Sagan talked about that keeps science on the path towards truth. The peer review process has served science very well for centuries. And he wanted, when it comes to National Science Foundation proposals, wanted to get rid of peer review and replace it with congressional evaluation. And talk about trying to politicize science. There could be no greater example than the sorts of acts that folks like Lamar Smith have engaged in recent years.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that actually has come out, too, is that, again, there's been an attempt to smear you by misquoting or misrepresenting a comment you made just, I guess, not that long ago, around just how bad the impact of climate change is right now. You made a statement that said, it's so bad that you can see it without the need for scientific tools. And that got turned around to sort of say, Michael Mann's abandoning everything he's actually spent his life fighting for.
Right. I mean, again, it gets at the issue of honesty, of intellectual honesty. And, you know, our critics, that sort of betrays their motives and their modus operandi. They're not engaged in good faith discourse. They're looking to misrepresent intentionally every single thing you say. You know, I'm very outspoken, and I do lots of interviews. And so I'm sure they would love it if I would stop speaking, speaking out. And I suppose one way they try to do that is by trying to twist my words when I do speak out, and especially when I speak out particularly effectively, I suppose. And I thought that that was sort of an effective moment when I was giving testimony to the Democratic National Committee at that particular time. And you know, I pointed out in response that if these critics knew anything, they could have easily checked my website and seen that I had published nearly a dozen scientific peer-reviewed publications within the last year and a half, where indeed I did use sophisticated statistical methods to look at climate data. So obviously I wasn't saying that there is not a use for sophisticated statistical methods in climate science. What I was simply pointing out was that many of the impacts have become so profound that we no longer need subtle tools for detecting signals to see them. We can see them with our own eyes. And you know what? I think the person on the street understands that because they're seeing that. They know what I mean. And I don't think that particular attack was very effective. I think it was just to serve notice that, hey, you know, when you speak out, we're going to twist your words. We're going to try to embarrass you by twisting your words. That doesn't work. And it's really beneath contempt. And it speaks volumes, again, about the intellectual honesty of those who are attacking us.
Right. And the program that they actually are putting into force, too, because this is very serious on that level, too, in terms of, look, this can make a huge difference. What happens in relation to the climate has everything to do with not just the survival of humans, but actually the planet itself and everything that's in it, all the things that are living and growing and everything else. It could just become a dead planet at some point as a result of some of the stuff that's being put into action now, which to me is...
Well, that's right. I mean, that's what makes it so pernicious. It's what, at some level, makes it evil. Mm-hmm. Those who would knowingly try to confuse the public about a grave threat that fundamentally threatens our planetary existence, what could be more immoral, unethical, than that?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. All right, Mike, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Thank you. Always great talking. Always happy to come back.
Yeah, definitely, man. We'll look forward to it. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Right, bye now. All right, we've just been talking with Dr. Michael Mann. Dr. Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science and the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. His research focuses on understanding climate variability and human-caused climate change. He's authored more than 200 publications and 3 books, including Dire Predictions, Understanding Climate Change, The Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars, and The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank everybody who worked on the show today. My assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Kiana Williams. I also want to thank all of the guests on the show, Carl Dix and Michael Mann. And I also want to thank Outer National for allowing us to actually present their new song, Decision. And if any of you want to reach me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a song that I just stumbled on recently, and it's a really powerful song. It's from Green Day's new album, and it's called Troubled Times. Says a lot about today. Talk to you again next week.
Troubled time.